investigator was that fellow Barbara, which is why no charges were filed. It was a wash. Or am I wrong, Peter? Absolutely not, Randolph said, although he too looked uneasy. These fellows are all at least 21, and I believe Carter Thibodeau might be 23. Thibodeau was indeed 23 and had lately been working as a part-time mechanic at Mill Gas and Grocery. He'd been fired from two previous jobs. Temper issues, Randolph had heard, but he seemed to have settled down at the gas and grocery. Johnny said he'd never had anyone so good with exhaust and electrical systems. They've all hunted together. They're good shots.
Please, God, we don't have to put that to the test, Andrea said.
No one's going to get shot, Andrea, and no one's suggesting we make these young fellows full-time police. What I'm saying is that we need to fill out an extremely depleted roster, and fast. So how about it, Chief? They can serve until the crisis is over, and we'll pay them out of the contingency fund. Randolph didn't like the idea of Junior toting a gun on the streets of Chester's Mill. Junior with his possible behavioral issues. But he also didn't like the idea of bucking Big Jim. And it really might be a good idea to have a few extra wide bodies on hand, even if they were young. He didn't anticipate problems in town, but they could be put on crowd control out where the main roads hit the barrier. If the barrier was still there. And if it wasn't, problems solved. He put on a team player smile. You know, I think that's a great idea, sir. You send him around to the station tomorrow around 10.
9 might be better, Pete.
9's fine, Andy said in his dreamy voice.
Further discussion? Rennie asked. There was none. Andrea looked as if she might have had something to say, but couldn't remember what it was.
Then I call the question, Rennie said. Will the board ask Acting Chief Randolph to take on Junior, Frank DeLesseps, Melvin Searles, and Carter Thibodeau as deputies at base salary? Their period of service to last until this darn crazy business is sorted out. Those in favor signify in the usual manner. They all raise their hands. The measure is approved. He was interrupted by two reports that sounded like gunfire. They all jumped. Then a third came, and Rennie, who had worked with motors for most of his life, realized what it was. Relax, folks, just a backfire. Generator clearing its throat. The elderly Jenny backfired a fourth time, then died. The lights went out, leaving them for a moment in Stygian blackness. Andrea shrieked. On his left, Andy Sanders said,
"Oh my gosh, Jim, the propane!"
Rennie reached out with his free hand and grabbed Andy's arm. Andy shut up. As Rennie was relaxing his grip, light crept back into the long pine-paneled room. Not the bright overheads, but the emergency box lights mounted in the four corners. In their weak glow, the faces clustered at the conference table's north end looked yellow and years older. They looked frightened. Even Big Jim Rennie looked frightened. "No problem," Randolph said with a cheeriness that sounded manufactured rather than organic. "Tank just ran dry, that's all. Plenty more in the town supply barn." Andy shot Big Jim a look. It was no more than a shifting of the eyes. But Rennie had an idea. Andrea saw it. What she might eventually make of it was another question.
"She'll forget it after her next dose of oxy," he told himself.
"By morning, for sure. And in the meantime, the town's supplies of propane, or lack thereof, didn't concern him much. He would take care of that situation when it became necessary.
"Okay, folks, I know you're as anxious to get out of here as I am, so let's move on to our next order of business.
I think we should officially confirm Pete here as our chief of police, pro tem."
"Yes. Why not?"
Andy asked. He sounded tired.
"If there's no discussion," Big Jim said, "I'll call the question."
They voted as he wanted them to vote. They always did. 7. Junior was sitting on the front step of the big Rennie home on Mill Street when the lights of his father's Hummer splashed up the driveway. Junior was at peace. The headache had not returned. Angie and Dodie were stored in the McCain pantry, where they would be fine, at least for a while. The money he'd taken was back in his father's safe. There was a gun in his pocket, the Pearl Grip 38 his father had given him for his 18th birthday. Now he and his father would speak. Junior would listen very closely to what the King of No Money Down had to say. If he sensed his father knew what he, Junior, had done, he didn't see how that was possible, but his father knew so much. Then Junior would kill him. After that, he would turn the gun on himself, because there would be no running away. Not tonight. Probably not tomorrow, either. On his way back, he had stopped on the town common and listened to the conversations going on there. What they were saying was insane, but the large bubble of light to the south, and the smaller one to the southwest, where 117 ran toward Castle Rock, suggested that tonight, insanity just happened to be the truth. The door of the Hummer opened, chunked closed. His father walked toward him, his briefcase banging one thigh. He didn't look suspicious, wary, or angry. He sat down beside Junior on the step without a word. Then, in a gesture that took Junior completely by surprise, he put a hand on the younger man's neck and squeezed gently. "You heard?" he asked. "Some," Junior said. "I don't understand it, though." "None of us do. I think there are going to be some hard days ahead while this gets sorted out. So I have to ask you something." "What's that?" Junior's hand closed around the butt of the pistol. "Will you play your part, you and your friends, Frankie, Carter, and the Searles boy?" Junior was silent, waiting. What was this shit? "Peter Randolph's acting chief now. He's going to need some men to fill out the police roster. Good men. Are you willing to serve as a deputy until this damn cluster mug is over?" Junior felt a wild urge to scream with laughter, or triumph, or both. Big Jim's hand was still in the nape of his neck, not squeezing, not pinching, almost caressing. Junior took his hand off the gun in his pocket. It occurred to him that he was still on a roll. The roll of all rolls. Today, he had killed two girls he'd known since childhood. Tomorrow, he was going to be a town cop. "Sure, Dad," he said. "If you need us, we are there." And for the first time in maybe 4 years, it could have been longer, he kissed his father's cheek. Prayers. 1. Barbie and Julia Shumway didn't talk much. There wasn't much to say. Theirs was, as far as Barbie could see, the only car on the road. But light streamed from most of the farmhouse windows once they cleared town. Out here, where there were always chores to be done and no one fully trusted Western Maine Power, almost everyone had a Jenny. When they passed the WCIK radio tower, the two red lights at the top were flashing as they always did. The electric cross in front of the little studio building was also lit, a gleaming white beacon in the dark. Above it, the stars spilled across the sky in their usual extravagant profusion, a never-ending cataract of energy that needed no generator to power it. "Used to come fishing out this way," Barbie said. "It's peaceful." "Any luck?" "Plenty, but sometimes the air smells like the dirty underwear of the gods, fertilizer or something. I never dared to eat what I caught." "Not fertilizer, bullshit. Also known as the smell of self-righteousness."
"I beg your pardon?"
She pointed at a dark steeple shape blocking out the stars. "Christ the Holy Redeemer Church," she said. "They own WCIK just back the road. Sometimes known as Jesus Radio." He shrugged. "I guess maybe I have seen the steeple. And I know the station. Can't very well miss it if you live around here and own a radio. Fundamentalist?" "They make the hard-shell Baptists look soft. I go to the Congo myself. Can't stand Lester Coggins. Hate all the ha-ha, you're going to hell and we're not stuff. Different strokes for different folks, I guess. Although I have often wondered how they afford a 50,000-watt radio station."
"Love offerings?"
She snorted. "Maybe I ought to ask Jim Rennie. He's a deacon." Julia drove a trim Prius hybrid, a car Barbie would not have expected of a staunch Republican newspaper owner, although he supposed it did fit a worshiper at the First Congregational. But it was quiet, and the radio worked. The only problem was that out here on the western side of town, CIK's signal was so powerful it wiped out everything on the FM band. And tonight, it was broadcasting some holy accordion shit that hurt Barbie's head. It sounded like polka music played by an orchestra dying of bubonic plague. "Try the AM band, why don't you?" she said. He did, and got only nighttime gabble, until he hit a sports station near the bottom of the dial. Here, he heard that before the Red Sox-Mariners playoff game at Fenway Park, there had been a moment of silence for the victims of what the announcer called the Western Main Event. "Event," Julia said. "A sports radio term if I ever heard one. Might as well turn it off." A mile or so past the church, they began to see a glow through the trees. They came around a curve and into the glare of lights almost the size of Hollywood premier Kleeg's. Two pointed in their direction. Two more were tilted straight up. Every pothole in the road stood out in stark relief. The trunks of the birches looked like narrow ghosts. Barbie felt as if they were driving into a noir movie from the late 1940s. "Stop, stop, stop," he said. "This is as close as you want to go. Looks like there's nothing there, but take my word for it, there is. It would likely blow the electronics in your little car, if nothing else." She stopped and they got out. For a moment, they just stood in front of the car, squinting into the bright light. Julia raised one hand to shield her eyes. Parked beyond the lights, nose to nose, were two brown canvas-back military trucks. Sawhorses had been placed on the road for good measure, their feet braced with sandbags. Motors roared steadily in the darkness, not one generator but several. Barbie saw thick electrical cables snaking away from the spotlights and into the woods, where other lights glared through the trees. "They're going to light the perimeter," he said, and twirled one finger in the air like an ump signaling a home run. "Lights around the whole town, shining in and shining up."
"Why up?"
"The up ones to warn away air traffic. If any gets through, that is. I'd guess it's mostly tonight they're worried about. By tomorrow they'll have the airspace over the mill sewn up like one of Uncle Scrooge's money bags." On the dark side of the spotlights, but visible in their backsplash, were half a dozen armed soldiers, standing at parade rest with their backs turned. They must have heard the approach of the car, quiet as it was, but not one of them so much as looked around. Julia called, "Hello, fellas." No one turned. Barbie didn't expect it. On their way out, Julia had told Barbie what Cox had told her, but he had to try, and because he could read their insignia, he knew what to try. The army might be running this show. Cox's involvement suggested that, but these fellows weren't army. "Yo, Marines," he called. Nothing. Barbie stepped closer. He saw a dark horizontal line hanging on the air above the road, but ignored it for the time being. He was more interested in the men guarding the barrier, or the dome. Shumway had said Cox called it the dome. "I'm surprised to see you force recon boys stateside," he said, walking a little closer. "That little Afghanistan problem over, is it?" Nothing. He walked closer. The grit of the hardpan under his shoes seemed very loud. "A remarkably high number of pussies in Force Recon, or so I've heard. I'm relieved, actually. If this situation was really bad, they would have sent in the Rangers."
"Pokey bait," one of them muttered.
It wasn't much, but Barbie was encouraged. "Stand easy, fellas. Stand easy, and let's talk this over." More nothing. And he was as close to the barrier, or the dome, as he wanted to go. His skin didn't rash out in goosebumps, and the hair on his neck didn't try to stand up, but he knew the thing was there. He sensed it, and could see it, that stripe hanging on the air. He didn't know what color it would be in daylight, but he was guessing red, the color of danger. It was spray paint, and he would have bet the entire contents of his bank account, currently just over $5,000, that it went all the way around the barrier. "Like a stripe on a shirt sleeve," he thought. He balled a fist and rapped on his side of the stripe, once more producing that knuckles-on-glass sound. One of the Marines jumped. Julia began, "I'm not sure that's a good..." Barbie ignored her. He was starting to be angry. Part of him had been waiting to be angry all day, and here was his chance. He knew it would do no good to go off on these guys. They were only spear carriers,
but it was hard to bite back. Yo, Marines, help a brother out.
Quit it, pal.
Although the speaker didn't turn around, Barbie knew it was the CO of this happy little band. He recognized the tone, had used it himself, many times.
We've got our orders, so you help a brother out. Another time, another place, I'd be happy to buy you a beer or kick your ass, but not here, not tonight, so what do you say?
I say okay, Barbie said. But seeing as how we're all on the same side, I don't have to like it. He turned to Julia. Got your phone? She held it up. You should get one, they're the coming thing.
I have one, Barbie said. A disposable Best Buy special. Hardly ever use it. Left it in a drawer when I tried to blow town. Saw no reason not to leave it there tonight. She handed him hers.
You'll have to punch the number, I'm afraid. I've got work to do.
She raised her voice so the soldiers standing beyond the glaring lights could hear her. I'm the editor of the local newspaper, after all, and I want to get some pics.
She raised her voice a little more.
Especially a few of soldiers standing with their backs turned on a town that's in trouble.
Ma'am, I kind of wish you wouldn't do that, the CO said. He was a blocky fellow with a broad back.
Stop me, she invited.
I think you know we can't do that, he said. As far as our backs being turned, those are our orders.
Marine, she said, you take your orders, roll them tight, bend over, and stick them where the air quality is questionable.
In the brilliant light, Barbie saw a remarkable thing, her mouth set in a harsh, unforgiving line, and her eyes streaming tears. While Barbie dialed the number with the weird area code, she got her camera and began snapping. The flash wasn't very bright, compared to the big generator-driven spotlights, but Barbie saw the soldiers flinch every time it went off. Probably hoping their fucking insignia doesn't show, he thought.
2.
United States Army Colonel James O. Cox had said he'd be sitting with a hand on the phone at 10:30. Barbie and Julia Shumway had run a little late, and Barbie didn't place the call until 20 of 11, but Cox's hand must have stayed right there, because the phone only managed half a ring before Barbie's old boss said,
Hello, this is Ken.
Barbie was still mad, but laughed just the same.
Yes, sir, and I continue to be the bitch who gets all the good shit.
Cox also laughed, no doubt thinking they were off to a good start.
How are you, Captain Barbara?
Sir, I'm fine, sir, but with respect, it's just Dale Barbara now. The only things I captain these days are the grills and friolators in the local restaurant, and I'm in no mood for small talk. I am perplexed, sir, and since I'm looking at the backs of a bunch of pogey bait Marines who won't turn around and look me in the eye, I'm also pretty goddamn pissed off.
Understood. And you need to understand something from my end. If there was anything at all those men could do to aid or end this situation, you would be looking at their faces instead of their asses. Do you believe that?
I'm hearing you, sir. Which wasn't exactly an answer.
Julia was still snapping. Barbie shifted to the edge of the road. From his new position, he could see a bivouac tent beyond the trucks. Also, what might have been a small mess tent, plus a parking area filled with more trucks. The Marines were building a camp here, and probably bigger ones where Route 119 and 117 left town. That suggested permanence. His heart sank.
Is the newspaper woman there?
Cox asked.
She's here, taking pictures.
And sir, full disclosure, whatever you tell me, I tell her. I'm on this side now.
Julia stopped what she was doing long enough to flash Barbie a smile.
Understood, Captain.
Sir, calling me that earns you no points.
All right, just Barbie. Is that better?
Yes, sir.
As to how much the lady decides to publish, for the sake of the people in that little town of yours, I hope she's got sense enough to pick and choose.
My guess is she does.
And if she emails pictures to anyone on the outside, one of the news magazines or the New York Times, for instance, you may find your internet goes the way of your landlines.
Sir, that's some dirty shit.
The decision would be made above my pay grade. I'm just saying.
Barbie sighed. I'll tell her. Tell me what? Julia asked.
That if you try to transmit those pictures, they may take it out on the town by shutting down internet access.
Julia made a hand gesture Barbie did not ordinarily associate with pretty Republican ladies. He returned his attention to the phone.
How much can you tell me?
Everything I know,
Cox said. Thank you, sir. Although Barbie doubted Cox would actually spill everything. The Army never told everything it knew. Or thought it knew.
We're calling it the Dome,
Cox said.
But it's not a dome. At least we don't think it is. We think it's a capsule, whose edges conform exactly to the borders of the town. And I do mean exactly.
Do you know how high it goes?
It appears to top out at 47,000 and change. We don't know if the top is flat or rounded. At least not yet.
Barbie said nothing. He was flabbergasted.
As to how deep, who knows? All we can say now is more than 100 feet. That's the current depth of an excavation we're making on the border between Chester's Mill and the unincorporated township to the north.
TR-90.
To Barbie's ears, his voice sounded dull and listless.
Whatever. We started in a gravel pit that was already dug down to 40 feet or so. I've seen spectrographic images that blow my mind. Long sheets of metamorphic rock that have been sheared in two. There's no gap, but you can see a shift where the northern part of the sheet dropped a little. We've checked seismographic reports from the Portland Meteorological Station, and bingo, there was a bump at 11:44 a.m., 2.1 on the Richter. So, that's when it happened.
Great, Barbie said.
He supposed he was being sarcastic, but he was too amazed and perplexed to be sure.
None of this is conclusive, but it's persuasive. Of course, the exploring has just started, but right now it does look as if the thing is down, as well as up. And if it goes up 5 miles...
How do you know that? Radar?
Negative. This thing doesn't show on radar. There's no way of telling it's there until you hit it. Or until you're so close you can't stop. The human toll when the thing went up was remarkably low, but you've got one hell of a bird kill around the edges. Inside and outside.
I know, I've seen them.
Julia was done with her pictures now. She was standing next to him listening to Barbie's end of the conversation.
So, how do you know how high it is? Lasers?
No, they also shoot right through. We've been using missiles with dummy warheads. We've been flying F-15A sorties out of Bangor since 4 this afternoon. Surprised you didn't hear them.
I might have heard something, Barbie said, but my mind was occupied with other things.
Like the airplane, and the pulp truck, the dead people out on Route 117, part of the remarkably low human toll. They kept bouncing off. And then at 47,000 plus, just zippity-zoom, up, up and away. Between you and me, I'm surprised we didn't lose any of those fighter jocks.
Have you actually overflown it yet?
Less than 2 hours ago. Mission successful.
Who did it, Colonel?
We don't know.
Was it us? Is this an experiment that went wrong? Or, God help us, some kind of test? You owe me the truth. You owe this town the truth. These people are goddamn terrified.
Understood. But it wasn't us.
Would you know if it was?
Cox hesitated. When he next spoke, his voice was lower.
We have good sources in my department. When they fart in the NSA, we hear it. The same is true about Group 9 at Langley, and a couple of other little deals you never heard of.
It was possible that Cox was telling the truth, and it was possible he wasn't. He was a creature of his calling, after all. If he had been drawing sentry duty out here in the chilly autumn dark with the rest of the Pogie Bait Marines, Cox, too, would have been standing with his back turned.
He wouldn't have liked it. But orders were orders.
Any chance it's some sort of natural phenomenon? Barbie asked.
One that conforms exactly to the man-made borders of a whole town, every nook and fucking cranny, what do you think?
I had to ask, is it permeable, do you know?
Water goes through, Cox said. A little, anyway.
How is that possible?
Although he'd seen for himself the weird way water behaved, both he and Gendron had seen it.
We don't know. How could we?
Cox sounded exasperated.
We've been working on this less than 12 hours. People here are slapping themselves on the back just for figuring out how high it goes. We may figure it out, but for now, we just don't know.
Air?
Air goes through to a greater degree. We've set up a monitoring station where your town borders on...
Faintly, Barbie heard paper rustle.
Harlow. They've done what they call puff tests. I guess that must measure outgoing air pressure against what bounces back. Anyway, air goes through, and a lot more freely than water does, but the scientists say still, not completely. This is going to severely fuck up your weather, pal, but nobody can say how much or how bad. Hell, maybe it'll turn Chester's Mill into Palm Springs.
He laughed rather feebly. Particulates? Barbie thought he knew the answer to that one.
Nope, Cox said. Particulate matter doesn't go through, at least we don't think so, and you want to be aware that works both ways. If particulate matter doesn't get in, it won't get out. That means auto emissions.
Nobody's got that far to drive. Chester's Mill is maybe 4 miles across at its widest, along a diagonal. He looked at Julia. 7 tops, she said.
Cox said, we don't think oil heat pollutants are going to be a big deal either. I'm sure everybody in town has a nice expensive oil furnace. In Saudi Arabia, they have bumper stickers on their cars these days saying, I heart New England. But modern oil furnaces need electricity to provide a constant spark. Your oil reserves are probably good, considering the home heating season hasn't started yet, but we don't think it's going to be very useful to you. In the long run, that may be a good thing, from the pollution standpoint.
You think so? Come on up here when it's 30 below zero and the wind's blowing it. He stopped for a moment. Will the wind blow?
We don't know, Cox said. Ask me tomorrow and I may at least have a theory.
We can burn wood, Julia said. Tell him that. Miss Shumway says we can burn wood.
People have to be careful about that, Captain Barbara... Barbie... Sure, you've got plenty of wood up there, and you don't need electricity to ignite it and keep it going, but wood produces ash. Hell, it produces carcinogens.
Heating season here starts... Barbie looked at Julia. November 15th, she said, or thereabouts. Miss Shumway says mid-November, so tell me you're going to have this worked out by then.
All I can say is that we intend to try like hell. Which brings me to the point of this conversation. The smart boys, the ones we've been able to convene so far, all agree that we're dealing with a force field.
Just like on Star Trek, Barbie said. Beam me up, Snotty.
Beg your pardon?
Doesn't matter. Go on, sir.
They all agree that a force field doesn't just happen. Something either close to the field of effect or in the center of it has to generate it. Our guys think the center is most likely. Like the handle of an umbrella, one of them said.
You think this is an inside job?
We think it's a possibility. And we just happen to have a decorated soldier in town.
Ex-soldier, Barbie thought. And the decorations went into the Gulf of Mexico 18 months ago. But he had an idea his term of service had just been extended, like it or not. Held over by popular demand, as the saying went.
Whose specialty in Iraq was hunting down Al-Qaeda bomb factories. Hunting them down and shutting them down.
So, basically just another Jenny. He thought of all those he and Julia Shumway had passed on the way out here, roaring away in the dark, providing heat and light, eating propane to do it. He realized that propane and storage batteries, even more than food, had become the new gold standard in Chester's Mill. One thing he knew, people would burn wood. If it got cold and the propane was gone, they'd burn plenty. Hardwood, softwood, trashwood. And fuck the carcinogens.
It won't be like the generators working away in your part of the world tonight, Cox said. A thing that could do this, we don't know what it would be like, or who could build such a thing.
But Uncle Sammy wants it, Barbie said. He was gripping the phone almost tightly enough to crack it. That's actually the priority, isn't it, sir?
Because a thing like that could change the world. The people of this town are strictly secondary.
Collateral damage, in fact.
Oh, let's not be melodramatic, Cox said. In this matter, our interests coincide. Find the generator if it's there to be found. Find it the way you found those bomb factories and then shut it down. Problem solved.
If it's there.
If it's there, roger that. Will you try?
Do I have a choice?
Not that I can see, but I'm career military. For us, free will isn't an option.
Ken, This is one fucked up fire drill. Cox was slow to reply. Although there was silence on the line, except for a faint high hum that might mean the proceedings were being recorded, Barbie could almost hear him reflecting. Then he said,
"That's true, but you still get all the good shit, you bitch."
Barbie laughed. He couldn't help it. 3. On the way back, passing the dark shape that was Christ the Holy Redeemer Church, he turned to Julia. In the glow of the dashboard lights, her face looked tired and solemn. "I won't tell you to keep quiet about any of this," he said, "but I think you should hold one thing back. The generator that may or may not be in town." She took a hand off the wheel, reached back, and stroked Horace's head, as if for comfort and reassurance. "Yes. Because if there's a generator spinning the field, creating your colonel's dome, then somebody must be running it. Somebody here." Cox didn't say that, but I'm sure it's what he thinks. "I'll withhold that, and I won't email any pictures."
"Good.
They should run first in the Democrat anyway, damn it." Julia continued stroking the dog. People who drove one-handed usually made Barbie nervous, but not tonight. They both had little bitch and 119 to themselves. "Also, I understand that sometimes the greater good is more important than a great story, unlike the New York Times."
"Zing," Barbie said.
"And if you find the generator, I won't have to spend too many days shopping at Food City. I hate that place."
She looked startled.
"Do you think it'll even be open tomorrow?"
I'd say yes. People can be slow to catch up with the new deal when the old deal changes.
"I think I better do a little Sunday shopping," she said thoughtfully.
"When you do, say hello to Rose Twitchell. She'll probably have the faithful Anson Wheeler with her." Remembering his earlier advice to Rose, he laughed and said, "Meet, meet, meet."
"Beg your pardon?"
"If you have a generator at your house."
"Of course I do. I live over the newspaper. Not a house, a very nice apartment. The generator was a tax deduction."
She said this proudly.
"Then buy meat. Meat and canned goods. Canned goods and meat."
She thought about it. Downtown was just ahead now. There were far fewer lights than usual, but still plenty.
For how long? Barbie wondered.
Then Julia asked, "Did your colonel give you any ideas about how to find this generator?"
"Nope,"
Barbie said. "Finding shit used to be my job. He knows that."
He paused, then asked,
"Do you think there might be a Geiger counter in town?"
"I know there is, in the basement of the town hall. Actually, the sub-basement, I guess you'd say. There's a fallout shelter there."
"You're shitting me," she laughed.
"No shit, Sherlock. I did a feature story on it 3 years ago. Pete Freeman took the pictures. In the basement, there's a big conference room and a little kitchen. The shelter's half a flight of stairs down from the kitchen. Pretty good sized. It was built in the 50s, when the smart money was on us blowing ourselves to hell."
"On the beach," Barbie said.
"Yep, see that and raise you, alas, Babylon. It's a pretty depressing place. Pete's pictures reminded me of the Fuhrer bunker, just before the end. There's a kind of pantry, shelves and shelves of canned goods, and half a dozen cots. Also some equipment supplied by the government, including a Geiger counter."
"The canned stuff must be extremely tasty after 50 years.
"Actually, they rotate in new goods every so often. There's even a small generator that went in after 9/11. Check the town report, and you'll see an appropriation item for the shelter every 4 years or so. Used to be $300, now it's $600. You've got your Geiger counter."
She shifted her eyes to him briefly.
"Of course, James Rennie sees all things town hall, from the attic to the fallout shelter, as his personal property. So he'll want to know why you want it."
"Big Jim Rennie isn't going to know," he said. She accepted this without comment.
"Would you like to come back to the office with me? Watch the president's speech while I start comping the paper? It'll be a quick and dirty job, I can tell you that. One story, half a dozen pictures for local consumption. No Burpee's Autumn Sales Day circular."
Barbie considered it. He was going to be busy tomorrow, not just cooking, but asking questions. Starting the old job, all over again, in the old way. On the other hand, if he went back to his place over the drugstore, would he be able to sleep?
"Okay," and I probably shouldn't be telling you this, but I have excellent office boy skills. I also make a mean cup of coffee. Mister, you are on. She raised her right hand off the wheel and Barbie slapped her five. Can I ask you one more question, strictly not for publication?
Sure, he said.
This sci-fi generator, do you think you'll find it? Barbie thought it over as she pulled in beside the storefront that housed the Democrats' offices. No, he said at last. That would be too easy. She sighed and nodded. Then she grasped his fingers. Would it help, do you think, if I prayed for your success?
Couldn't hurt, Barbie said. 4. There were only two churches in Chester's Mill on Dome Day. Both pervade the Protestant brand of goods, although in very different ways. Catholics went to Our Lady of Serene Waters in Motton, and the town's dozen or so Jews attended Congregation Beth Shalom in Castle Rock when they felt in need of spiritual consolation. Once there'd been a Unitarian church, but it had died of neglect in the late 80s. Everyone agreed it had been sort of hippy-dippy anyway. The building now housed Mill new and used books. Both Chester's Mill pastors were what Big Jim Rennie liked to call knee-bound that night, but their modes of address, states of mind, and expectations were very different. The Reverend Piper Libby, who ministered to her flock from the pulpit of the First Congregational Church, no longer believed in God, although this was a fact she had not shared with her congregants. Lester Coggins, on the other hand, believed to the point of martyrdom, or madness, both words for the same thing, perhaps. The Rev Libby, still wearing her Saturday grubs, and still pretty enough, even at 45, to look good in them, knelt in front of the altar in almost total darkness. The Congo had no generator, with Clover, her German shepherd, lying behind her with his nose on his paws and his eyes at half-mast.
Hello, Not There, Piper said.
Not There was her private name for God just lately. Earlier in the fall, it had been the Great Maybe. During the summer, it had been the Omnipotent Could Be. She'd liked that one. It had a certain ring.
You know the situation I've been in. You should. I've bent your ear about it enough. But that's not what I'm here to talk about tonight, which is probably a relief to you.
She sighed.
We're in a mess here, my friend. I hope you understand it, because I sure don't. But we both know this place is going to be full of people tomorrow, looking for heavenly disaster assistance.
It was quiet inside the church. Quiet outside, too. Too quiet, as they said in the old movies. Had she ever heard the mill this quiet on a Saturday night? There was no traffic, and the bass thump of whatever weekend band happened to be playing at Dippers, always advertised as being direct from Boston, was absent.
I'm not going to ask that you show me your will, because I'm no longer convinced you actually have a will. But on the off chance that you are there, after all, always a possibility, I'm more than happy to admit that. Please, help me to say something helpful. Hope not in heaven, but right here on earth, because...
She was not surprised to find that she had started to cry. She bawled so often now, although always in private. New Englanders strongly disapproved of public tears from ministers and politicians. Clover, sensing her distress, whined. Piper told him to hush, then turned back to the altar. She often thought of the cross there as the religious version of the Chevrolet bow tie, a logo that had come into being for no other reason than because some guy saw it on the wallpaper of a Paris hotel room 100 years ago and liked it. If you saw such symbols as divine, you were probably a lunatic. Nevertheless, she persevered.
Because, as I'm sure you know, Earth is what we have, what we're sure of. I want to help my people, that's my job, and I still want to do it. Assuming you're there and that you care, shaky assumptions, I admit, then please help me. Amen.
She stood up. She had no flashlight, but anticipated no trouble finding her way outside with unbarked shins. She knew this place step for step, and obstacle for obstacle. Loved it, too.
She didn't fool herself about either her lack of faith or her stubborn love of the idea itself.
Come on, Clove, she said. President, in half an hour. The other great not there. We can listen on the car radio.
Clover followed placidly, untroubled by questions of faith. 5. Out on Little Bitch Road, always referred to as Number 3 by Holy Redeemer worshippers, a far more dynamic scene was taking place, and under bright electric lights. Lester Coggins' house of worship possessed a generator new enough for the shipping tags still to be pasted on its bright orange side. It had its own shed, also painted orange, next to the storage barn behind the church. Lester was a man of 50, so well-maintained, by genetics as well as his own strenuous efforts to take care of the temple of his body, that he looked no more than 35. Judicious applications of Just for Men helped in this regard. He wore nothing tonight but a pair of gym shorts, with Oral Roberts' golden eagles printed on the right leg, and almost every muscle on his body stood out. During services, of which there were 5 each week, Lester prayed in an ecstatic televangelist tremolo, turning the big fellow's name into something that sounded as if it could have come from an overamped wah-wah pedal. Not God, but God. In his private prayers, he sometimes fell into these same cadences without realizing it. But when he was deeply troubled, when he really needed to take counsel with the God of Moses and Abraham, he who traveled as a pillar of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night, Lester held up his end of the conversation in a deep growl, then made him sound like a dog on the verge of attacking an intruder. He wasn't aware of this because there was no one in his life to hear him pray. Piper Libby was a widow who had lost her husband and both young sons in an accident 3 years before. Lester Coggins was a lifelong bachelor who, as an adolescent, had suffered nightmares of masturbating and looking up to see Mary Magdalene standing in his bedroom doorway. The church was almost as new as the generator, and constructed of expensive red maple. It was also plain to the point of starkness. Behind Lester's bare back stretched a triple rank of pews beneath a beamed ceiling. Ahead of him was the pulpit, nothing but a lectern with a Bible on it and a large redwood cross hanging on a drape of royal purple. The choir loft was above and to the right with musical instruments, including the Stratocaster Lester himself sometimes played, clustered at one end.
God, hear my prayer, Lester said in his growly, I'm really praying voice.
In one hand he held a heavy length of rope that had been knotted 12 times, one knot for each disciple. The 9th knot, the one signifying Judas, had been painted black.
God, hear my prayer. I ask it in the name of the crucified and risen Jesus.
He began to whip himself across the back with the rope, first over the left shoulder and then over the right, his arm rising and flexing smoothly. His not inconsiderable biceps and delts began to pop a sweat. When it struck his already well-scarred skin, the knotted rope made a carpet beater sound. He had done this many times before, but never with such force.
God, hear my prayer. God, hear my prayer. God, hear my prayer. God, hear my prayer. Whack and whack and whack and whack, the sting like fire like nettles, sinking in along the turnpikes and byroads of his miserable human nerves, both terrible and terribly satisfying.
Lord, we have sinned in this town, and I am chief among sinners. I listened to Jim Rennie and believed his lies. Yea, I believed, and here is the price. And it is now as it was of old. It's not just the one that pays for the sin of one, but the many. You are slow to anger, but when it comes, your anger is like the storms that sweep a field of wheat, laying low not just one stock or a score, but every one. I have sowed the wind and reaped the whirlwind, not just for one, but for many.
There were other sins and other sinners in the mill. He knew that. He was not naive. They swore and danced and sexed and took drugs he knew far too much about. And they no doubt deserved to be punished, to be scourged. But that was true of every town, surely, and this was the only one that had been singled out for this terrible act of God. And yet, was it possible that this strange curse was not because of his sin? Yes, possible, although not likely.
Lord, I need to know what to do. I'm at the crossroads. If it's your will that I should stand in this pulpit tomorrow morning and confess to what that man talked me into, the sins we participated in together, the sins I have participated in alone, then I will do so. But that would mean the end of my ministry, and it's hard for me to believe that's your will at such a crucial time. If it's your will that I should wait and see what happens next. Wait and pray with my flock that this burden should be lifted, then I'll do that. Your will be done, Lord, now and always.
He paused in his scourging. He could feel warm and comforting trickles running down his bare back. Several of the rope knots had begun to turn red, and turned his tear-stained face up toward the beamed roof.
Because these folks need me, Lord. You know they do, now more than ever. So, if it's your will that this cup should be removed from my lips, please, give me a sign.
He waited.
And behold, the Lord God said unto Lester Coggins, I will shew you a sign. Goest thou to thy Bible, even as you did as a child after those nasty dreams of yours.
This minute, Lester said, this second.
He hung the knotted rope around his neck, where it printed a blood horseshoe on his chest and shoulders, then mounted to the pulpit with more blood trickling down the hollow of his spine and dampening the elastic waistband of his shorts.
He stood at the pulpit as if to preach, although never in his worst nightmares had he dreamed of preaching in such scant garb. Closed the Bible, lying open there, then shut his eyes.
Lord, thy will be done. I ask in the name of your Son, crucified in shame and risen in glory.
And the Lord said, open my book and see what you see.
Lester did as instructed, taking care not to open the big Bible too close to the middle. This was an Old Testament job, if ever there had been one. He plunged his finger down to the unseen page, then opened his eyes and bent to look. It was the second chapter of Deuteronomy, the 28th verse. He read, the Lord shall smite thee with madness and blindness and astonishment of the heart. Astonishment of the heart was probably good, but on the whole this wasn't encouraging or clear.
Then the Lord spake again, saying,
don't stop there, Lester.
He read the 29th verse.
And thou shalt grope at noonday. Yes, Lord, yes,
he breathed and read on.
As the blind gropeth in darkness, and thou shalt not prosper in thy ways, and thou shalt be only oppressed and spoiled evermore, and no man shall save thee.
Will I be struck blind?
Lester asked, his growly prayer voice rising slightly.
Oh God, please don't do that, although,
if it is thy will.
The Lord spake unto him again, saying, did you get up on the stupid side of the bed today, Lester?
His eyes flew wide. God's voice, but one of his mother's favorite sayings, a true miracle.
No, Lord, no.
Then look again. What am I shewing you?
It's something about madness or blindness.
Which of the two dost thou thinkest most likely?
Lester scored the verses. The only word repeated was blind.
Is that, Lord, is that my sign?
The Lord answered, saying, yea, verily, but not thine own blindness, for now thine eyes see more clearly. Lookest thou for the blinded one who has gone mad? When you see him, you must tell your congregation what Rennie has been up to out here, and your part in it. You both must tell. We'll talk about this more, but for now, Lester, go to bed. You're dripping on the floor.
Lester did, but first he cleaned up the little splatters of blood on the hardwood behind the pulpit. He did it on his knees. He didn't pray as he worked, but he meditated on the verses. He felt much better. For the time being, he would speak only generally of the sins which might have brought this unknown barrier down between the mill and the outside world. But he would look for the sign. For a blind man or woman who had gone crazy, yea, verily. 6. Brenda Perkins listened to WCIK because her husband liked it. Had liked it. But she would never have set foot inside the Holy Redeemer Church. She was Congo to the core. And she made sure her husband went with her. Had made sure. Howie would only be in the Congo church once more. Would lie there, unknowing, while Piper Libby preached his eulogy. This realization, so stark and immutable, struck home. For the first time since she'd gotten the news, Brenda let loose and wailed. Perhaps because now she could. Now, she was alone. On the television, the president, looking solemn and frighteningly old, was saying, "My fellow Americans, you want answers, and I pledge to give them to you as soon as I have them. There will be no secrecy on this issue. My window on events will be your window. That is my solemn promise." "Yeah, and you've got a bridge you want to sell me," Brenda said, and that made her cry harder because it was one of Howie's faves. She snapped off the TV, then dropped the remote on the floor. She felt like stepping on it and breaking it, but didn't, mostly because she could see Howie shaking his head and telling her not to be silly. She went into his little study instead, wanting to touch him somehow while his presence here was still fresh, needing to touch him. Out back, their generator purred. Fat and happy, Howie would have said. She'd hated the expense of that thing when Howie ordered it after 9/11. Just to be on the safe side, he'd told her. But now she regretted every sniping word she'd said about it. Missing him in the dark would have been even more terrible, more lonely. His desk was bare, except for his laptop, which was standing open. His screensaver was a picture from a long-ago Little League game. Both Howie and Chip, then 11 or 12, were wearing the green jerseys of the Sanders hometown drug monarchs. The picture had been taken the year Howie and Rusty Everett had taken the Sanders team to the state finals. Chip had his arms around his father, and Brenda had her arms around both of them. A good day, but fragile. As fragile as a crystal goblet. Who knew such things at the time, when it still might be possible to hold on a little? She hadn't been able to get hold of Chip yet, and the thought of that call, supposing she could make it, undid her completely. Sobbing, she got down on her knees beside her husband's desk. She didn't fold her hands, but put them together palm to palm, as she had as a child, kneeling in flannel pajamas beside her bed and reciting the mantra of "God bless Mom, God bless Dad, God bless my goldfish who doesn't have a name yet." "God, this is Brenda. I don't want him back. Well, I do, but I know you can't do that. Only give me the strength to bear this, okay? And I wonder if maybe, I don't know if this is blasphemy or not, probably it is, but I wonder if you could let him talk to me one more time. Maybe let him touch me one more time like he did this morning." At the thought of it, his fingers on her skin in the sunshine, she cried even harder. "I know you don't deal in ghosts, except of course for the Holy One. But maybe in a dream. I know it's a lot to ask, but, oh God, there's such a hole in me tonight. I didn't know there could be such holes in a person, and I'm afraid I'll fall in. If you do this for me, I'll do something for you. All you have to do is ask. Please, God, just a touch, or a word, even if it's in a dream." She took a deep, wet breath. "Thank you. Thy will be done, of course, whether I like it or not." She laughed weakly. "Amen." She opened her eyes and got up, holding the desk for support. One hand nudged the computer and the screen brightened at once. He was always forgetting to turn it off. But at least he kept it plugged in so the battery wouldn't run down. And he kept his electronic desktop far neater than she did. Hers was always cluttered with downloads and electronic sticky notes. On Howie's desktop,
always just three files stacked neatly below the hard disk icon. Current, where he kept reports of ongoing investigations. Court, where he kept a list of who, including himself, was down to testify, and where, and why. The third file was Morin Street Manse, where he kept everything having to do with the house. It occurred to her that if she opened that one, she might find something about the generator, and she needed to know about that so she could keep it running as long as possible. Henry Morrison from the PD would probably be happy to change the current propane canister, but what if there were no spares? If that were the case, she should buy more at Burpee's or the gas and grocery before they were all gone. She put her fingertip on the mouse pad, then paused. There was a fourth file on the screen lurking way down in the left-hand corner. She had never seen it before. Brenda tried to remember the last time she'd happened to look at the desktop of this computer and couldn't. Vader, the file name read. Well, there was only one person in town Howie referred to as Vader, as in Darth. Big Jim Rennie. Curious, she moved the cursor to the file and double-clicked it, wondering if it was password-protected. It was. She tried Wildcats, which opened his current file. He hadn't bothered to protect court. And it worked. In the file were two documents. One was labeled Ongoing Investigation. The other was a PDF doc titled Letter from SMAG. In Howie speak, that stood for State of Maine Attorney General. She clicked on it. Brenda scanned the AG's letter with growing amazement as the tears dried on her cheeks. The first thing her eye happened on was the salutation. Not Dear Chief Perkins, but Dear Duke. Although the letter was couched in lawyer speak rather than Howie speak, certain phrases leaped out at her as if in bold-faced type. Misappropriation of town goods and services was the first. Selectman Sanders' involvement seems all but certain was the next. Then, this malfeasance is wider and deeper than we could have imagined 3 months ago. And near the bottom, seeming not just in boldface, but in capital letters, manufacture and sale of illegal drugs. It appeared that her prayer had been answered, and in a completely unexpected way. Brenda sat down in Howie's chair, clicked Ongoing Investigation in the Vader file, and let her late husband talk to her. 7. The President's Speech, long on comfort, short on information, wrapped up at 12:21 a.m. Rusty Everett watched it in the third-floor lounge of the hospital, made a final check of the charts, and went home. He had ended days more tired than this during his medical career, but he had never been more disheartened or worried about the future. The house was dark. He and Linda had discussed buying a generator last year and the year before because Chester's Mills always lost its power 4 or 5 days each winter, and usually a couple of times in the summer as well. Western Maine Power was not the most reliable of service providers. The bottom line had been that they just couldn't afford it. Perhaps if Lynn went full-time with the cops, but neither of them wanted that with the girls still small. At least we got a good stove and a hell of a wood pile, if we need it. There was a flashlight in the glove compartment, but when he turned it on, it emitted a weak beam for 5 seconds and then died. Rusty muttered an obscenity and reminded himself to stock up on batteries tomorrow, later today, now, assuming the stores were open. If I can't find my way around here after 12 years, I'm a monkey. Yes, well, he felt a little like a monkey tonight. One fresh caught and slammed into a zoo cage. And he definitely smelled like one. Maybe a shower before bed. But nope. No power, no shower. It was a clear night. And although there was no moon, there were a billion stars above the house. And they looked the same as ever. Maybe the barrier didn't exist overhead. The president hadn't spoken to that issue, so perhaps the people in charge of investigating didn't know yet. If the mill were at the bottom of a newly created well instead of caught underneath some weird bell jar, then things might still work out. The government could airdrop supplies. Surely if the country could spend hundreds of billions for corporate bailouts, then it could afford to parachute in extra Pop-Tarts and a few lousy generators. He mounted the porch steps,
taking out his house key. But when he got to the door, he saw something hanging over the lock plate. He bent closer, squinting, and smiled. It was a mini flashlight. At Burpee's end-of-summer blowout sale, Linda had bought 6 for $5. At the time, he'd thought it a foolish expenditure. He even remembered